Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a battle space in that war that comes and goes in terms of our attention to it, but that deserves considerably more, is, of course, Latin America, and in particular, the festering sore of the Maduro regime. That would be Nicolas Maduro, the heir to Hugo Chavez, who has run his country literally into the ground. We have the chance to speak about this matter from time to time with Russ Dallin. He is the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. A big story has come across our scope recently, and that involves a company many of us know here in the United States for its gasoline stations, Citgo. Russ, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney.
Let me ask you about this Citgo matter. Remind us what the relationship of Citgo is to the Venezuelan government, and what has lately happened to Citgo's, financials, and the implications for perhaps the opposition of the country, not just the government.
So Citgo has a long and storied history in the United States. Actually, it was one of the first stocks that Warren Buffett ever bought and made money on. And it's also known, obviously, for its huge sign at Fenway Park in Boston. Aside from that, in two steps, the Venezuelan government, via its national state oil company, PDVSA, Petróleos de Venezuela, by its initials, PDVSA, or PDVSA in Spanish, acquired the first half of Citgo, and then the second half, so that it became a wholly owned subsidiary of Petróleos de Venezuela, PDVSA, which was fine. They needed a great distribution network. Citgo has always had the cheapest gas around, or it did in the early years, because Venezuelan oil was heavier and cheaper, and the Venezuelans had a sure thing in it. Citgo produces about 750,000 barrels a day. It is the responsible for about 4% of the fuel supply in the United States. It is now, unfortunately, under Venezuelan control. Now that our friendship with Venezuela seems to have come to an end, as that country became increasingly communist and authoritarian. However, because of the break between the U.S. recognizing Maduro and switching its allegiance and recognition to the leader of the National Assembly there, who became the interim president, the opposition under Juan Guaido, who is the president of the National Assembly and now the president of Venezuela that the U.S. and 58 other countries recognize, is now in charge of Citgo. So it has come under the opposition's control. They are running it well and effectively, which is much easier to do when you're not stealing from it all the time. So it has become an effective oil company again. However, Venezuela on the way has also defaulted on over $65 billion worth of bond debt that it issued in international markets over the last 2 years, or defaulted during the last 2 years, but also they owe about $150 billion in debts, and they've stopped paying, except, of course, to their sponsoring states, China and Russia and Rosneft. But for the Westerners, they've stopped paying, and those Westerners are looking to get paid, including Crystal X, which is a gold mining company, a Canadian gold mining company that's had a gold mining venture in Venezuela that Hugo Chavez expropriated and put the company in bankruptcy. Crystal X went into bankruptcy, but the only thing they had was their expropriation claim against Venezuela. They brought suit before the World Bank's arbitration panel. They won a $1.4 billion judgment for the expropriation by Hugo Chavez. It took them 8 years, but they got that registered in the United States after it was issued, and then they went after Venezuela's assets in the United States or elsewhere in the world to seek redress for their claim and their injuries and damages from their expropriation.
And of course, Citgo's assets being prominent among those in the United States, they've gone after them. So what does this mean for the effort to displace the Maduro regime, Russ Dallin? Is this likely to be something that could benefit Juan Guaido and his alternative, or is it just a net, you know, negative for both Maduro and Guaido?
It cuts both ways. It would be a shame for Venezuela, assuming that there is going to be the regime change the United States seeks, to lose the asset of Citgo, which is a what we'd call as close to a sure thing as you can get in the business, because you can ship 750,000 barrels to it automatically and get paid the same day. So if we're going to rebuild a democratic and capitalist Venezuela, it is an asset that the future government would want to have. However, we don't want the Maduro regime to have it. And right now we're kind of in that halfway place where the Maduro government doesn't have it, but the Guaido government does. But the Guaido government is being left to pay all of the debts that the Maduro government ran up during its 20 years of Chavez and Maduro partying and stealing and theft, and the opposition is being left to pay that that bill.
Now, is there a precedent in the international arena of late, Russ, to protect Guaido and his team from those creditors and enable them to get Venezuela back on its feet if they can get Maduro out of the country?
Yes, is the short answer. And in the 2000s, during the second Iraqi war, led by George Bush the Younger, the United Nations, at the direction of under the leadership of the United States, was able to successfully pass a UN Security Council resolution protecting the assets of Iraq for 4 years until the country could get back on its feet. So basically from 2003 to 2007, under the UN resolution, Security Council resolution, creditors were stopped from taking or seizing Iraqi assets until that country could get back on its feet. The Venezuelan opposition is seeking a similar rule. However, Russia and China are patron states of Venezuela and are not
creditors too, as you say.
Yes, they're creditors and patrons, and they're not. They don't recognize Guaido, and they're not. They're not happy to assist in this protection. They just want to get their own money paid.
And prop him up, Maduro, of course, as well. Well, this will be a sticky wicket, obviously. I look forward to further exploring with you what should be the way ahead here, Russ Dallin. There does seem to be an opportunity to turn this to advantage in the effort to finally free the people of Venezuela from the predations of Nicolas Maduro, but it is going to take some doing, needless to say. Thank you for joining us with your insights as always, Russ. We appreciate them, as well as the work you do at the Latin American Herald Tribune and, of course, Caracas Capital. Good to talk with you, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Diana West joins us.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by a regular feature of this program. She is the great Diana West, an author, a pundit, an insightful commentator now for, well, decades. Diana, good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, wonderful to be back, Frank.
Diana, I've been off for a little bit, and in my absence, there was considerable thrashing going on up on the Hill last week with Robert Mueller. And I wanted to talk to you about sort of your overall impressions of what went on there, but specifically to ask you to address a theme that we've talked about in the past, but that seems to me now to be taking on even greater urgency in light of what took place with respect to this Well, this problem you call the original sin of the whole anti-Trump campaign, that is to say this charge that he has been involved or was involved or his campaign was involved, at least in sort of collusion with the Russians, evidenced by their penetration of the DNC, Democratic National Committee, databases and so on. Tell us what we should think about all this.
Yes, well, I think we're watching a crime being committed, and it's a thought crime, it's a memory crime, it's a history crime, and essentially we are supposed to believe, based on no evidence, that Russia interfered in the 2016 election on behalf of Donald Trump. And it goes back to this original sin notion, which is this delegitimizing concept, which all turns on the claim that Russia hacked the DNC. This goes back to July, the releases through WikiLeaks in July of 2016 of DNC emails that were very embarrassing, revealed great corruption on the part of the DNC officials who were throwing the primary season to Hillary Clinton, trying to rig it against Bernie Sanders. This is essentially the story that comes out in 2016 in July, but it was turned very
deftly. And let me just say, collusion with the Clinton campaign as well. We don't want to give them a pass in this. They
exactly.
were actively working with the Democratic National Committee officials who were corruptly trying to throw it. Yeah, got it.
And they all turned it. This was actually a very signal moment by then campaign Clinton campaign manager Robbie Mook, turns it immediately in an interview with Jake Tapper, who's basically saying, hey, what about this corruption and collusion against Bernie Sanders, turns it into a national security event, an attack by Russia on our presidential election. And we've been off on that tangent ever since, regardless of the very seminal fact. And here's where our time comes in and the crime that's being committed against all of us today, based on no evidence that Russia did indeed hack the DNC. And this is verified by the fact that the FBI never examined the server. No other independent authority ever examined the server. This is based on a claim by a DNC contractor that has been laundered through all of the security agencies, the intelligence agencies, the courts at this point, FISA court, and so on, into coming into this hardwired fact that ultimately is delegitimizing Donald Trump going forward. And we will see, we will return to this in the 20 campaign cycle. I am certain of it. And this was not brought out in the Mueller hearings. And indeed, in all of the investigations that we're talking about and all of the sort of facts being summoned once again, now it is being erased.
So let me tease this out a little bit. You say, Diana West, there's no evidence that the Russians hacked the DNC servers. I said databases. I meant servers, because what was on them that was potentially of great moment were, of course, emails documenting this collusion between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee's leadership under Debbie Wasserman Schultz. When you say that, there has been evidence pointed to, and I want you to, again, work through what was that evidence. You mentioned a DNC contractor. This is CrowdStrike, I believe. You mentioned the FBI and its evaluation of CrowdStrike's, you know, investigation. Walk us through, again, what exactly happened and why it, at the end of the day, amounts to no evidence in your estimation.
Yes. Well, very simply, the fact is, imagine a bank has been robbed, and the bank president, rather than calling in the police, calls up a friend to do an investigation and then presents a redacted version of his friend's report, because indeed this is what happened, to the police and said, this is the guy who did it. That's not the way the real world works.
And in that case, let's just say it, the FBI would be involved in the bank heist for some reason. The FBI, rather than investigating the alleged perpetrator, rather than evaluating all of the forensic evidence supporting the thesis of the crime, just takes the word of the bank president's friend.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is literally what happened, because what we now know, and this is through Roger Stone's lawsuit just a few weeks ago, we now know Roger Stone is basing his defense on this incredible scandal that the FBI, the U.S. government, never investigated these servers and just simply took this claim that Russia is the narrative here. Russia attacked the election for Donald Trump. His lawsuit is trying to expose this in court, and he's
now,
being
it reminds
stopped
how he fits into this whole story.
He has been indicted by Robert Mueller based on some process crimes, some crimes committed during the course of the Mueller investigation into Russian interference. And essentially, he is out to prove there was no Russian interference and certainly no evidence of Russian interference that the U.S. government has. And in the course of his legal travails, he's now under the most severe kind of gag order, but in the course of his travails, his lawyers have learned from the Justice Department that the FBI did not even see the full CrowdStrike report. They were presented a draft that was redacted. Not just
this is not anywhere remotely close to the actual evidence itself. This is not what was shown about the servers. And you on this program and elsewhere have recalled that some people who know their way around these things, notably some former employees of the National Security Agency, the NSA, have done some rather more, shall we say, aggressive investigations of all of this and come to a very different conclusion than the FBI has. Is that correct?
Well, this is the flip side of it, and this is the other part of the crime against the American people, because this group, it's a group called VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. It's led by a very notable figure from the NSA, former NSA 30-year career official who was NSA tech director at the time that he left as a whistleblower, actually, someone who created some of the metadata collection systems that are still in use today, the man by the name of William Binney, a very respected authority on all of this. His team has looked at the documents that have been released, all of the emails that are out in the public record that have these timestamps and other kinds of information that they are able to analyze to create recreate what kind of release out of a server these documents underwent. And essentially, the short story and the layman story is that when something is hacked over distance of the internet, there is a slow exit of these documents that is reflected in the timestamps.
It sort of trickles out, as we all know.
And, you know, when you try to download anything, not hacking, but just anything from a distance, one, had this occurred, the NSA itself would have this evidence. There would be no need for a private firm to go in and tinker around. This would be known by our NSA that collects everything on these lines. So in other words, there would exist hard evidence of this kind of a hack already without a private firm hired by the DNC.
And that's not the case, that there
that is
no NSA.
Not the case.
File.
Nothing has been presented. No. And two, the analysis of this team, and they did quite rigorous testing, trying from things from different parts of the world to try to get different times and speeds. They conclude that this particular dump of data had to have been downloaded onto something like a thumb drive or other storage device, which suggests somebody on the inside, certainly not a foreign Russian hack, no evidence of that, at least at this point, that has been given to us, only the say-so, again, of a DNC contractor, co-founded by a man named Sean Henry, who was a protege of Robert Mueller's at the FBI back in the day.
Oh, my Lord.
Yes, and another man
detail.
I believe his name is Dmitry Alperovich, who has associations with the Atlantic Council, which is considered one of these globalist entities in Washington. So who's also
Russian
born in Russia.
And a Russian expat, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, actually
curious
born in Russia.
Curious or incurious. Okay, Diana, so we have to wrap here, but I just want to ask you to tie this all together. The thought crime, as you put it, this is an Orwellian term, of course, that is vaporizing fact and history and supplanting it with a false narrative. What is the implication of all of that for Donald Trump's A, presidency, and B, reelection campaign?
Yes, well, it's more of a memory hole crime, I guess, since we're going back to Orwell. But the implication for Donald Trump and his campaign is that no matter what kind of justice we are meted out in terms of admissions of this or that malfeasance by various actors against the Trump campaign, the underlying delegitimizing narrative based on no good solid evidence remains, namely that Russia interfered in the 2016 election on behalf of Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton. That remains rock solid in terms of being left without any challenge and without showing this incredible malfeasance on the part of all of the actors involved across both parties who have not exposed this and brought this to the American people.
This is a hugely important issue. We will come back to it, I know, with you. Dinah West, thank you so much for joining us today and for the incredibly important work you continue to do. I commend everybody the Red Thread. Dinah, come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, David Goldman joins us.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a distinct pleasure to say each week that we're able to visit with David Goldman, an extraordinary, well, Renaissance man, a financial maven professionally, but an author both of countless extraordinarily important columns, not infrequently under the byline Spengler at Asia Times. He's also the author of How Civilizations Die, and a man we are privileged to call a friend, as well as a great resource here at Secure Freedom Radio. David Goldman, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank, and it's my privilege entirely.
Thank you. You have come up with a very interesting way of addressing, as a serious student of these matters, what China is up to. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about it with our audience, specifically sort of the economic agenda of the China dream that Xi Jinping has fashioned, notably, I guess, being implemented through his Belt and Road Initiative. Tell us about it.
Well, I think you can encapsulate China's intent with the idea that they want to turn the world economy into China's company store. You borrow money from the company store, you never get out of debt. You work with the tools that the company store gives you. You produce the things that the company store wants you to do, and you're entirely beholden to China for financing, for technology, for trade routes, and for security. That's most vivid in a number of third world countries where the Chinese have gotten countries into debt, seized their ports and so forth, and then come in and say, well, you can work for us and work off the debt. We'll give you the telecommunications, and by the way, we'll charge you for the upgrades every year. We'll give you the e-commerce. Alibaba and Tencent will come in and help you market your products, and they'll take a cut on everything that you sell. We'll control the logistics, and we'll take a cut of that. So everything you do is going to be under the purview of the Chinese Empire, and we'll take our cut everywhere down the line, and you'll never get out from under our control.
Right. It's a fantastically powerful metaphor, I think, for what's afoot. And I'm so appreciative of you talking about it. And one piece of this that, you know, takes the company store, I guess, to a whole new level of control is, as you mentioned, that everything you say, everything you communicate through their networks will be essentially mined or, you know, manipulated or utilized against you by the company management. No?
Well, think of the way Microsoft got so rich. If you have the operating system, people have got to buy your spreadsheet and your word processor. I'm showing my age, but once upon a time, I used WordPerfect and Lotus 1-2-3, which are perfectly good programs, but they were exterminated by Microsoft, because if you've got the operating system, you have to use the applications. The point about 5G internet, which the Chinese dominate, Huawei is the world leader in this. They've invested, you know, $100 billion in R&D over the last 7 or 8 years. They really are ahead of us, which is a scary thing, is not just that they will control all of the communications hardware, not even a matter of whether they steal the data or not. They'll control all the applications because 5G allows you to do 100 other things you can't do now. It makes possible much safer autonomous vehicles. It makes possible a whole new range of factory automation. On the military side, it makes possible the Internet of Things. It makes possible effective drone swarms because you need a vast amount of data and very fast computation to control drone swarms. It's a great theory that we haven't yet put into practice. So if the Chinese
But they're hard at work at, I think it's fair to say.
They are hard at work on all of these things in artificial intelligence. So the idea is that once they get the operating system, by analogy, once they control the 5G standards and the basic patents and they control the hardware, then they will dominate all of the applications as well. So they'll become to the Internet of Things and industrial controls and defense what Microsoft was to Office applications.
Yeah, fantastically interesting thought. Let me turn to a sort of related topic. At the National Conservatism Conference recently, you addressed yourself to sort of the impact that the China company store enterprise has had via globalization on not just third world countries distant from here, but on Americans as well. You've come up with a recommended recourse for us to try to respond to it. Tell us about that, David Goldman.
Well, the new conservative populace, people like J.D. Vance, with whom I certainly sympathize, talk about the suffering of Americans in areas that have been deindustrialized by globalization. Their livelihoods have been wiped out. Their communities have been ruined. The problem is there's a limit to how much we can spend to help people who need help until we get more productivity and produce the wealth that we require to help them. We're already spending more than 70% of the federal budget on transfer payments, up from about 16% when I was a boy in the 1960s. We can't go that much further. The basic problem we have now is that there's no investment going into capital-intensive industry in the United States of America. That's because the Asians massively subsidized their capital-intensive industries, so all the inventions of American ingenuity that created the modern digital age, every one of them came from the United States, but virtually none of them are being produced in the United States. So my view is we need a Kennedy-style moonshot, a Reagan-style strategic defense initiative, a top-down defense driver with a aggressive Manhattan Project-style R&D campaign to raise American productivity. Now, that doesn't directly help the people in West Virginia who've lost coal mining or steel jobs and who are suffering. But the fact is, unless we can restore American productivity and American industrial prowess to the best in the world, we face a constraint on our ability to help people who need help. So I'm all of the populists in helping people who have a requirement. These are fellow Americans, and we can't leave them behind, but we also have to run the business that will produce the income that we need to help them.
And stave off the company store headed our way, as well as elsewhere in the world. In PJ Media, you recently wrote, David, about President Trump's campaign against the so-called squad, the radical leftists, four females in particular, now in the Congress. And you argue that he has the moral high ground in his efforts to challenge what they're doing. Talk about what it is they're doing and why he has the moral high ground and how that might play out in the upcoming election cycle.
Well, the squad is demanding that Americans reduce themselves to a racial identity and accept a racial profile as the basis of politics. That is called racism. That's old-fashioned racism. That's got nothing to do with the civil rights movement. Judge a man by the content of his character, not the color of his skin. So when President Trump calls out a racist like Ilhan Omar and says, if you don't like it here, you can go back to where you came from, I'm going to go back to some other country, that's exactly the right thing to say. The Democrats are scandalously deficient in addressing racism in their own party. And I specifically refer to Ilhan Omar's open and flagrant, unapologetic anti-Semitism. When she says that Israel has hypnotized the world and that Israel's influence is about the Benjamin's baby, it's first of all a deep insult to the vast number of Americans, particularly evangelical Christians, who support Israel as a matter of conscience and deeply held belief. Israel is not around paying money to the evangelical Christians to support Israel, as anyone can tell you. So that's an affront to 100 million Americans right there. But it's also a classic anti-Semitic lie. That is a racist statement and a racist campaign by Ilhan Omar. And the fact the Democratic leadership has not censured her and not dissociated themselves from this racist taints them with the stain of racism themselves. So President Trump is not a racist, as the mainstream media keeps repeating. This is a Goebbels big lie. You repeat it enough, people will believe it. It's absolutely false. As President Trump says, there's not a racist bone in his body. It's a ridiculous accusation. The Democrats have racists in their ranks whom they refuse to rein in, and they have the racism problem. Therefore, President Trump has the moral high ground, and we shouldn't apologize or back down for a second in the face of these charges.
Yeah, this is such an important point, and I commend you for making it so forcefully. I guess I would just add as a fillip that it's not just that the Democratic leadership is failing to, you know, repudiate what's going on here, what the squad is up to, Ilhan Omar most aggressively. They're actually enabling it, aren't they, by essentially protecting the four women and others who are of a similar mind with them. And, you know, this is a throwback to some of the ancient history of the Democratic Party, which, of course, is redolent with racism and the KKK and Jim Crow and all that. We will be discussing this, I know, further with you, David Goldman, among others. And thank you very much again for your important clarifying comments on so many of these topics at Asia Times, PJ Media, and of course, here as well at Secure Freedom Radio. Come back to us again next week, if you would. We'll talk a bit further about this Ilhan Omar problem with the president of the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, right after this.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by my friend and colleague of many years, the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights. As those of you who listen to this program regularly know, he is an extraordinary career intelligence professional who has served both in the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, also served as an overseer of the intelligence community at the House Intelligence Committee under its chairman, Pete Hoekstra. He has also been the chief of staff to John Bolton at two points in his illustrious career as the Undersecretary of State, as well now as the National Security Advisor. He's come back to us, and we're very pleased to say that he's still with us. The president actively considered him for the position of the Director of National Intelligence, has now chosen Congressman John Ratcliffe for that purpose, which is good news for the Center for Security Policy. We're delighted to have you. Fred, bless you. Thank you so much for your time today. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here. It was an honor to be considered to be the DNI, and I'd like to congratulate Congressman John Ratcliffe. I know he's going to do a great job.
Me too. Fred, so much to talk about. I was discussing a moment ago with our friend David Goldman the president's efforts to really expose and challenge the behavior that has now become commonplace on the part of, well, I guess all four of the members of the so-called squad, the ladies who are members of Congress, but very radical leftists at best and worst sort of red-green axis types, one might say. Specifically, David was critical, as has the president been, of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. And I know you've written about this as well, specifically with respect to this sort of steady and indeed intensifying anti-Semitic and anti-Israel sort of rhetoric and now legislating. Talk a little bit about why this is such a problem, as you see it, for the United States, not just for the people she's specifically attacking.
Well, Frank, both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have said that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. And I'm proud that the House of Representatives, by an overwhelming margin, passed a resolution condemning the BDS movement recently. But in the midst of that debate, Congresswoman Omar submitted a resolution defending BDS. Now, the Democrats are trying to have it both ways. They have Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who are arguing for the BDS movement, claiming it is not anti-Semitic and trying to attack Israel as if it is an apartheid state. Frank, Omar's resolution made references to Nazi Germany, sanctions of Nazi Germany. That's the same as sanctions of Israel. This is reprehensible. And the fact is that Democrats are turning a blind eye to an appalling movement to the far left that Omar and Tlaib represent. Now, I'm glad that Pelosi and Schumer speak out occasionally on this. That's not enough. They have to stand up to these congresswomen. And President Trump is exactly right in calling them out for their hatred of Israel and anti-Semitism. This is growing on the left. It's a big threat to our country, and I'm glad President Trump is fighting it.
Let me just ask you on this apartheid question, Fred. I saw something the other day, and we're going to about the evidence that Israel is actually the nation that arguably has done the most to integrate the minority in their country, specifically the Arabs in their country, far from apartheid, by allowing them to serve in, among other places, the Israeli parliament, known as the Knesset, and even on the Supreme Court, for heaven's sakes, as well as to varying degrees in the Israeli Defense Force. This is just on the face of it, an outright defamatory smear to say that Israel is like South Africa, let alone Nazi Germany, is it not?
Our friend Ayan Hirsi Ali did a very compelling op-ed in the Wall Street Journal maybe 2 weeks ago entitled, Can Congresswoman Omar Overcome Her Anti-Semitism? And she taught about how when she grew up in Somalia, just like Omar did, she was taught to hate Jews and to hate the state of Israel, repulsive things that she writes in her article. She wrote about how she overcame this and how, in her opinion, Omar has not faced that she needs to reject this anti-Semitism, this hatred of Israel, and that the Democratic Party has to insist that she do so.
Let me turn to Iran. We've had, of course, seemingly escalating efforts by the Iranian government to lash out. And the Trump administration has played it rather cool so far. I was very pleased to see, though, that they took steps to sanction specifically one of the most odious characters in the Iranian regime, namely the Iranian foreign minister, substantially responsible for the negotiation of the, as you've called it in your book, Obama bomb deal. Talk to us about this fellow Zarif and why it is important that these sanctions be imposed upon him.
Well, Zarif is part of the problem. He's the foreign minister of Iran. He's driving Iran's policies to keep this fraudulent nuclear deal alive and to lead the effort by Iran to start pulling out of selective parts of the deal to blackmail European states, both to get back into the deal and to circumvent U.S. sanctions against Iran. So, you know, basically anyone playing part of this process by Iran, the Trump administration has decided to sanction. I think it was a good move.
Yeah, and I think one of the grounds on which they did this was his active involvement with a group that has now been designated as a foreign terrorist entity, namely the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And so for all these reasons, I hope this will make it more difficult for Zarif to exercise the kind of influence that he has. Fred, as you've seen this effort by the president to exercise maximum pressure, as he calls it, it's clear that it is taking its toll on the Iranian regime and its economy especially. One of the things that has been happening, though, that is clearly designed to circumvent that is ships that are coming to Iranian ports to take aboard oil from them that is supposed to not be possible under the sanctions regime. Apparently, one of the techniques that they're using is to turn off their transponders as they go into the Strait of Hormuz. This is a disaster waiting to happen, is it not? You could have an accident in those close quarters, even if it's not an intentional act of war by the Iranian government. The practical effect could be environmentally catastrophic and perhaps quite portentous for shipping and oil exports, legal exports, that is, and more generally.
That's exactly right. The Strait of Hormuz are very narrow with very carefully designated sea lanes coming in and out of the Persian Gulf. North Korea has engaged in such irresponsible activity and behavior. It doesn't surprise me that the Iranians and nations who are collaborating with them, probably China, are doing this. And this is just going to make the situation worse. And I think it requires that this maritime coalition that the U.S. is trying to put together, that we put this together fairly quickly to defend shipping in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah. What do you make of the efforts of the Brits to do something sort of independent of us in that regard, Fred?
I'm hoping the Brits are going to come along and work with us in an alliance. They're still irritated that President Trump withdrew from the fraudulent nuclear deal. I'm hoping their new prime minister is going to see the light, that it would be better that we work together and that this nuclear deal is essentially dead and it was a bad deal. I don't know that he's come to that decision yet, but I understand he's going to meet with President Trump soon, and I'm hoping that that will be something that the two of them agree on.
Well, I do too. Fred, very quickly, the North Koreans, you mentioned a moment ago, have shot off two more short-range ballistic missiles, apparently sort of in the general direction of South Korea, a bad sign for the future.
Well, they don't violate Kim's promise not to test longer range missiles, but I find it a troubling development, and I think we have to track down what it is that's motivating North Korea to do things that seem to go contrary to what Kim had promised at his meeting with the DMZ with President Trump. We need to engage in some pretty tough diplomacy and discussions with the North Koreans to get these nuclear talks moving.
Fred, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as your leadership of the Center for Security Policy. It's great to have you, as always. We look forward to talking with you again next week. And the same will go for you, our listeners. I look forward to talking with you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.